CliffCentral.com.
All right, CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday morning. Now, occasionally we have celebrities, occasionally we have politicians, occasionally we have artists. I'm just always more interested in those people who, behind the scenes, have affected all of society. And it's not saying too much to say that Robin Knox Grant has to be one of those people who had probably an indirect but a more effective, a greater effect, rather, on many of our childhoods than we would probably imagine. He also, I mean, entirely apart from his contribution to television, he's done a lot. He lectured at two universities, at UJ and Monash, as a Java educator. He's written several textbooks on the matter. And he's been one of the most in-demand corporate educators in South Africa, quite apart from the stuff that he did in TV. But the reason we wanted to have him in here was to talk about what he did at the SABC right from the beginning to the late 1980s, because I think many of the stories here behind the scenes are the kinds of things that will get a lot of people thinking about this. Pleasure to meet you, Robin.
Gareth, it's great to meet you. Great to be here. I'm in the radio studio now, again.
You look,
after so many years.
You look so familiar. Would I have ever seen you on television?
It's unlikely, seeing that it was such a long time ago. We're talking about 40. There were quite a few interviews I did through the 70s and the early 80s.
Right.
So, but you were a small child then. You know, for goodness sake, you were a baby.
I mean, the 80s, I can barely remember. Mubs was born in the 80s.
It's unlikely that you know, I have withdrawn from public view, shall we say.
But you were such an important influence on what happened on television in those times.
Look, you know, I was to a point. A more accurate description of my job would have been head of programs rather than head of television, because it very, very specifically excluded the news.
Right.
I was responsible for everything other than news and current affairs, thank God, because it made my life relatively easy, and the fact that, you know, you're still prepared to talk to me now.
No, so I'm blown away. So one of our listeners said that he went to dinner and one of his friends said he's going to bring his dad along. This was, you're the dad that was brought along.
Yes,
he said he sat there and listened to you telling these stories for hours and hours, and he found himself absolutely captivated by them.
I have my party tricks.
so listen, I mean, head of programming then at the SABC from the beginning of television.
From before the beginning of television. From the early television opened officially on the 5th of January 1976. And I was there. I mean, obviously, you know, I was, people had to make it happen.
Yeah.
I was appointed, I think, 1972, just before my 30th birthday, was my first official designation in a television job in the SABC, along with three other guys. My colleague, who was head of Afrikaans television, and then the two people above us up to sort of board level. So, yeah, I was there right from the very beginning. It was great.
The first broadcast, was it news?
No, the first broadcast, it was a news summary. And then it was the schedule, as I remember it, the schedule was divided between Afrikaans and English. So Tuesdays with Thursdays and Saturdays, the English had the second half of the evening, which was only 5 hours. It was no big deal. the first part of that Monday evening was Afrikaans, and then the English, sorry, it was English. Yeah, we took it. It was a children's program. And then on the Tuesday, and this was my big deal. I opened English television with the first episode of The World at War. Now, that'll mean nothing to you.
No, I remember it well.
Do you?
My dad used to love that show.
And, right.
And in fact, I think we used to tape it onto onto tape, and then he kept them and he labeled them and everything.
Yes.
There was a whole thing in our house about that show, The World at War. In fact, I can even remember how the music went.
Can you?
Yeah,
I mean, that's like amazing.
And listen to this.
Gareth,
those
you're a bit older than you obviously look in that case.
I've been alive for 1,000 years. I just hide it well. Do you remember this?
God, yes. Oh, yes, I do.
So
yes,
this show was about World War II, and
yes,
it was a documentary show.
It was a 26-part documentary show from the BBC. And look, there was a lot of, you know, people think that this whole thing just sort of happened.
Yeah.
No. My primary job at the beginning of television was to establish an industry. You know, just bear in mind.
There was nothing. I mean, people used to watch the pattern before.
You know, I can remember going in Elof Street in the center of Johannesburg, which was more significant than it is now, if you know what I mean by that. People used to queue up on the pavements to look at the test pattern of television sets in shop windows. It was extraordinary. It was amazing.
And TVs with these big cathode ray tubes.
Right, these huge things to queue up
Well,
behind.
Not even huge, actually. They were quite small.
Well, we had black and white portable ones in the beginning, which were about sort of, you know, about
the size of a modern computer.
That's right. Yeah. And in fact, I've still got one of them. And then they decided, you know, well, the black and whites weren't selling too well. So that got abandoned.
Needed color.
But the first thing that I had to do was to prove the press wrong, because we had a huge problem. The press loathed and were terrified of us. And possibly for reasons I can understand, because they were terrified we were going to kill their advertising.
Yeah.
You know, there was a huge pressure in this country for television, which started way back.
But hang on, how far after the rest of the world did television come to South Africa?
Well, Australia got television in 1960. Zimbabwe, Rhodesia as it was then, was also 1960. America got television, God, I mean, immediately after the Second World War. The first British television service went out in 1936.
Wow.
As early
so
as
we
that.
Were far behind.
We were way behind. We were way, 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 way behind. There weren't many countries in the world that didn't have television. In fact, people really couldn't believe it.
Do you think the government at that stage wanted to keep television waiting a little bit longer every time because it was something that they might not have been able to control?
Yes. Yeah, look, it wasn't a case of keeping it waiting a little bit longer. They specifically didn't want it. I mean, there was a man by the name of Albert Herzog at the cabinet of the NAT government who was determined. He was the Minister of Communication or whatever he was. He was determined that television wouldn't happen.
Really?
Absolutely. He was adamant about it.
Son of a bitch.
But what triggered it in terms of public demand was the landing, the moon landing in July 1969. There was such an awareness that we were the only country in the world that wasn't actually watching this thing happening. And that was a very, very, very big deal. You know, the moon landing now, you know, it's sort of part of history.
No, it was huge.
It was a very, very, very international big deal. You know, Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. And there was an acute awareness right throughout South Africa that we were being denied this experience. I mean, I remember I was in Durban that morning at 5:30 in the morning. I listened to the radio because I'd already come back from Canada, which is another chapter of my life. And it was within a few months after that the government appointed the Commission of Inquiry to investigate television. I'm talking nonsense. It wasn't 69. The Commission of Inquiry. Yes, it was. God, it was September 69. I'm getting confused.
Okay, no. That's all right.
Yeah,
I'm not going to hold you to any of this.
After that, they appointed the Commission of Inquiry to investigate the setting up of television here,
right,
with all that had implied. Because, bear in mind, we had nothing. We had a film industry. We had people that were making documentary films like Edgar Bold and various people like that. But there was nothing. We had to create everything from the very beginning.
And you had to go over and also buy programming.
That was part of my job.
And they would say to you, go over to America, go over to Europe.
No, what happened was that there is an international, marketplace, I suppose, where television people from all over the world get together in Cannes in the south of France every year. It happens about this time every year. And the television production organizations around the world bring their wares for sale.
Right.
Do they still
do it?
Oh, yes. Yes, yes. The television event is separate from the major film thing, which everybody knows about. Mm-hmm. And it happens about April, as I remember. It does, sure.
And then they would come and they'd say, well, we've got this show about this. There's a sitcom, there's a family show, there's a drama.
You'd get all the blurb.
Yeah.
And, you'd go there knowing the kind of things that you're looking for in order to balance your schedule.
But you also had pressures because while you wanted to bring shows that would deliver good ratings, you also had other concerns.
Well,
the government wouldn't allow you to put on anything that wasn't considered to be sanitary.
Yes, but I was incredibly fortunate because, I mean, taken that situation into today, my job would be impossible.
Yeah.
But the Americans were quite conservative. We're very conservative. You would never, ever get a four-letter word on an American network show in the 70s. It just would never have happened.
Yeah.
So they were very conservative compared to what they are now.
Yeah.
So it was relatively easy in that respect. I had the pick of these dozens of shows that were out there for the buying.
I mean, Cannes couldn't have been horrible either. I mean, you must have had
great.
A lot of fun. Must have been madness. You got all these people from TV and from film and from production and advertising, I suppose.
No, that's separate. Advertising is separate. These were just the television people, the people who are making decisions about network.
So would they bring out the stars as well?
Yes, sometimes, yeah. Not often, but sometimes they did.
Now, probably your single greatest contribution, if I have to level it down to the, was Dallas.
I would say that is the one that that most people remember that certainly generated huge amounts of money for the SABC. I mean, Dallas, you're not going to believe this, and people will find this very strange because nowadays, I mean, television, no big deal. But the entire country came to a standstill at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday evening.
Absolutely. My parents would make sure we were in bed.
Oh, God.
They would have their friends over. Or they'd go to their friends.
There was
a thing. No one did anything. The roads were quiet.
The roads were quiet. Peter Turin phoned me and he said, "You're killing my industry." Because nobody would go to the theater. The cinemas closed.
Everything closed down when the show came on.
The country came to a standstill on a Tuesday night at 9 o'clock.
Now, I believe that Dallas, even in America, the audience share that it managed to garner was massive.
It was absolutely huge.
There is no show. There's no Super Bowl show. There's no presidential address before Congress.
There's
no major news event that can compete with the kind of ratings that Dallas used to deliver.
It was incredible. And I don't think, to my knowledge, it's ever sort of happened since.
No.
I was particularly proud of the fact that we were the first country in the world outside of America to run Dallas.
Really?
So we had friends and family phoning from other parts of the world. Hey, what happened to JR that night? Or is Bobby okay?
That episode where JR was shot was the one that everybody in the whole universe watched.
In the whole universe, indeed, yes.
But now, what was the process? Because we didn't have the internet and we didn't have a means of delivering the content satellite.
No, not via satellite. 60mm film.
Okay, so what happened? How did it work?
Well, what happened was that the Americans would not release a copy of a roll of film until it had gone out in the States. And I think it went out in the States on a Saturday evening or sometime.
All right.
Or was it? I'm not sure. But the fact of the matter is I couldn't get it here before Tuesday morning.
And it was due for broadcast on Tuesday night
at 9 o'clock.
Would they fly it out on a plane?
No. It came on an ordinary South African Airways, a scheduled South African Airways flight from New York.
Right.
Via Ilha do Sol, which we didn't have a non-stop flight between. Them.
So someone would put a reel of film on
in the
cabin baggage.
Well, it was handled by people who handle that sort of thing. I mean, people that did.
Now,
yeah.
If you didn't have that roll of film,
oh God!
There would have been chaos, right?
It would have been a major.
And then they'd land on the Tuesday morning.
Mm.
Someone would.
The flight landed at about 10 o'clock, and then somebody, Jerry, I remember him, my assistant, he would drive to the airport and get the film. Mm-hmm. And it was a standing thing. Jerry, you phone me when you've got that thing in your hand.
And we didn't have cell phones.
No, we didn't have cell phones.
So where did he phone you from? From the airport?
He phoned me from the office of the agents that dealt with the situation, that he collected the box from. And he phoned me, and my secretary would know whether I was in a meeting, whatever, that phone call, because I couldn't relax until I knew that this roll of film was in the building. And so my Tuesdays for those 6 months were pretty hectic. You know, I used to sort of be on edge. You know, I mean, Gareth, can you imagine the situation of...
Millions of people would have been sitting in front of their TV and Dallas wouldn't come on.
An estimated 5 million people...
Huge.
...would be sitting...
More people than watch Jimmy Fallon.
Absolutely. Would sitting in this country and probably I personally would have had to do it because I carried the can.
Right.
I'd have to go on television and say, the only possible excuse would have been that the plane had crashed into the Atlantic. That people might have accepted. But I would have been drawn and quartered in the streets.
Did you ever have a problem?
No, we didn't, fortunately. Fortunately, we didn't. The thing arrived, it arrived on time, and I could say my Tuesdays were a lot better.
God, that's absolutely...
No, it's amazing.
Now, when you went to buy these programs and things, I would imagine that the production companies that made them, they would be very keen for you to buy the show.
Oh, certainly.
Because then they would have made a lot of money.
Certainly.
First of all, did the SABC give you a lot of money to spend?
You're not going to believe this. I had a blank check. And the reason why I had a blank check was because the...
No, the people at the SABC still have blank checks these days.
Well, yeah, I believe so. All right. Look, I mean, within reason. I'm not talking about, you know, within reason. But they... The SABC was a radio organization.
Yes.
The sort of budgets, production budgets that they were used to were an irrelevant amount of what one episode of a television program cost. Mm. So it was very difficult for the finance department, for my boss, never mind anybody else, to get used to the idea that these things cost sometimes millions of rand. And Gareth, for some other extraordinary reason, they actually trusted me. They really did.
Well, what other shows did you bring us? Because there are a lot of these that'll get people thinking. Name some of the shows that you brought.
So. Yeah, there was Dallas. There was Who's the Boss. There was
Who's the Boss.
The A-Team.
I remember Who's the Boss. The A-Team. That was my favorite show when I was a kid.
Of course it was.
I remember that.
Two's Company. Who were some of the other shows? My mind's gone blank.
MacGyver.
Yes, MacGyver. That was great. That was really wonderful.
I remember this. My brother and I, we were little kids. Yes. We were so obsessed with the A-Team.
Yes.
It was the defining show of our childhood.
There it is. Oh, the memories come flooding back.
Wow.
It's great.
And MacGyver.
Yes.
You mentioned that.
Yes.
Didn't you also do Airwolf?
Yes. The helicopter at Airwolf, yes.
See, this is incredible.
Because you've been doing your homework. All this stuff on there.
Only one person who could be responsible for all of these.
Those were all my shows, yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And obviously people just loved them. So were there any people who said to you that they didn't like any of your choices?
No. The only criticism I got, heavy criticism, was from the press, who had reason to be concerned because for the first 2 years, look, we didn't have advertising.
Yeah.
And then advertising started at the beginning of 1978. But, well, you can imagine, they had reason to be concerned. We were drawing huge audiences.
Mm.
And the advertisers were prepared to pay a lot of money.
Sure.
A lot of money. I mean, as I remember it, and I may be subject to correction here, Jack Siebert, if you're out there, you will certainly know Jack was the head of advertising administration in the SABC. But to my knowledge, people were paying up to 35,000 rand for 30 seconds in Dallas. Now, take that back to 1976.
That's in those days.
35,000 is no big deal now. But then...
That was...
It was
fortune.
It was a lot of money. So we're talking about 70,000 rand a minute in Dallas. And it made commercial sense for the advertisers because they're picking up a live audience of 5 million people.
Yeah.
So the SABC's financial position was somewhat better than it is at the moment.
Now, I mean, when you talk about these international shows, and obviously, I mean, there are a couple of others that I've found in the list here. Dynasty, Growing Pains.
Yes.
The Bill Cosby Show.
Oh, that was an interesting one.
Why? Why do you say it was interesting?
I say that because, you know, Gareth, mine was the most extraordinary job. In retrospect, it was amazing. I had a huge amount of authority. I mean, I knew very well what the SABC's policy was in terms of racial contact and black and white and all that sort of thing. But what is not known generally is that we didn't have just racial apartheid, we had cultural apartheid.
Mm.
The English service had to represent the English community of this country, and likewise the Afrikaans service. So for that reason, my Afrikaans colleagues used to say, well, you know, just die bloody Engelse, hulle moet dit doen,
so they'd let you do your own thing.
They accepted the fact that the English-speaking community's norms were somewhat different to that of the Afrikaners,
right.
And well, more liberal. So Bill Cosby, you know, is a black guy.
Yeah.
And I bought the series.
Mm-hmm.
But I bought it for the specific reason. Because it was a good show,
yeah.
But this, he was a very, the character that he played, we're not talking about the present Bill Cosby, whatever that implies.
Sure.
He was a very...
Yeah, you've heard it hasn't gone so well for him.
No, it hasn't gone well. I mean, I know that, which is very sad, but that's another story. The character that he played was a very upright, respectable doctor, professional person. And my subliminal reasons. I wanted white South Africans to see that not all black people are
laborers.
Right.
And that they don't all have low-level jobs.
That's
and that
exactly
they can have suburban families
That's exactly what the Bill Cosby Show was about.
Yeah.
So we ran this, and it was great. There was no negative reaction at all. Because apart from skin color, this is a perfectly acceptable, decent human being.
No, right. I know what you mean. In those days, that was the context.
Yeah,
People would look at everyone first from the point of view of what race were they, especially in this country, because it was legislated.
Right. So here we have somebody who is a family man, he's a professional man.
So didn't the government at some point say to you, or didn't someone at the SABC at some point say to you, this Bill Cosby is creating trouble for us because...
No, they never did.
Never did.
No, they did. And if they had, I would have said, what trouble is being created?
Yeah.
What are people complaining? What is the problem? There was another incident. I could keep you going all
no,
morning.
No, please, talk to me.
There was another incident in a thing called Rich Man, Poor Man. A series called Rich Man, Poor Man, which Peter Strauss and Nick Nolte. And we had a situation, it was also very popular. We had a situation where the bad guy was Nick Nolte. He was always getting himself into a lot of shit and trouble, and his good brother was the businessman. To cut a long story short, he was murdered. And his wife was a short, tiny little slim girl called Kate, I remember this so well. Nick's best friend was a huge American dude, a black dude, was his best friend. And there was a scene in which his funeral was held at sea and the coffin was slid into the water. And there was a spontaneous moment when his best friend just spontaneously put his arms around Kate and just hugged her as a spontaneous...
Which is what normal people do.
Absolutely, which is a spontaneous response from one human being to another. And I looked at this lot and I thought, I'm not going to have this taken out by some bozo down the line who's been following, you know, this is going on the air. And I piloted that episode personally all the way through the processes, because we had a thing where people check for technical quality and all that sort of stuff before films, go on there. Just make sure that thing's not broken.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about 16-minute film here. It's got to be run before.
But it would have been a controversial for a black man to hug a white woman on TV?
No. It wouldn't. But it, you know, physical contact, sexual contact, forget it. That's completely out. But there wasn't anything sexual in this thing. That had I been required to defend my decision, that's what I would have said. Mm. There was no...
But incredible, like now if you watch TV, these things don't even enter into the picture.
No, but of course they don't.
But in those days, this was...
It was a consideration.
You knew someone down the line might have seen it and taken it out.
Yes, yes, there was that possibility. Yes, there was. There was that possibility. So, you know, by virtue of my authority, I went up to the television building, which is the one up the road from the big office tower, which is where my office was. Uh-huh. And I said to the guys, where's the Rich Man, Poor Man film that's going on? They gave it to me out of the library. Very nervous. You know, I had to sign for it and all the rest of it. I'm a stickler for keeping to the rules. I don't break the rules myself. That's very important to me. Yeah. So, and they said, sir, you know it's going on. I said, sure, I know it's going on the air tonight. Please, will you have it back within an hour? And I took it to an editing, and I'd previously been a film editor, so I knew about editing equipment and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I made sure this particular sequence had not yet been taken out. It was there. So I took it back to the library and I said, this is going straight from here. It's been checked and I signed and it's going to Final Control to Telecine. It'll go on the air. It was also in the 9 o'clock slot. And when it went that evening, I stayed late and I went up to the control room and I said to the Final Control guy, you know, can I come in? And they said, yeah, of course.
You
know,
they weren't used to you being there. Right?
Well, no, although I did now and again go up there. And I sat at the back, and Axel was the guy's name on duty. And I said, Axel, just relax, you know. I just want to see what's going on, no problem. And this thing came on there and said, oh, my God, we're all going to lose our fucking heads. You know, this is the end. I said, Axel, relax. If anybody's going to lose their job, it's going to be me. I promise you it won't be you.
Yeah.
It's not going to happen. That's why I'm here. I just wanted to be sure that, you know, that you're okay about this. It's not your responsibility. So, sorry. And the next morning, we had a meeting with the head of the whole of programming, my boss. And he sat there sucking his pipe. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, Robin, I said, Peter, before you say another word, what complaints have you had? What reaction has there been? And I remember this so clearly, Gareth. He said nothing. He sat there sucking his pipe. I said, Peter, what reaction has there been to what happened last night? And he said, nee, that was nixny. I said, oh, so there wasn't any reaction at all, not a single person. Not a single phone call.
Not a complaint. Not a complaint letter,
that the government hasn't collapsed. We haven't been invaded.
Yeah.
Okay, are you? That's the situation. He said, "Yeah." And then we went on with the agenda. The only people that benefited out of that night were the clinics people because the reaction was incredible. People, it wasn't that people loved it. People were moved by it. It was so beautifully handled by the director, the production people.
Yeah.
It was a very, very, very emotionally moving scene.
But isn't it amazing to see how far we've come when a scene like that in a TV series should have been controversial then and now we regard it as normal.
But Gareth, it's these little things and it's these little things that I think...
But what about, you know, I mean, you were on the set when... In fact, you produced a news film for international television organizations, including the BBC, and one of them was an interview with B.J. Forster, who was the then Prime Minister.
Yes.
And he became irritated with some makeup lady?
No. What, look, I mean, he was such a grumpy old bastard anyway. Yeah. He really was. He was... And we didn't even have television studios. This was before television.
Yeah.
When I was working in the SABC had a news film department.
Right.
And we did news footage for overseas news organizations.
Didn't they also play the news in the cinemas before the movies?
Yeah, but that was a separate issue. Okay. Yes, they did.
Yeah.
Yes, they did. But that was a thing called African Mirror,
okay,
which was had nothing to do with SABC.
All right.
But we used to produce film material for overseas organizations, such as the assassination of Verwoerd in Parliament. That was a major news event that I was involved in. But this thing with Forster, we didn't have television studios, so we had a converted radio studio at Broadcast House in Commissioner Street. And we had lights, sun guns. They were hideous because you perspired under these things.
Yeah, they were hot as hell, right?
Very hot. Yeah. Very hot.
Okay.
So, you know, so we set the whole thing up and the 16mm camera and the sound and all the guys are there. including Nola Slater. I remember her name, the makeup lady. Now, as you will know, they put a bit of powder or something on your face just to stop your face, shining.
Right.
So the guy walks in with his entourage, and I greet him, Mr. Foster, and, sit here and all the rest of it. She approached him with her powder puff, and his reaction was, "Lost my eight. Yeah. Lost my eight. That's what he had to make a market, and that's what it is." So, and she
wouldn't have makeup on.
Oh, no. He wouldn't let Nola come near him.
That's ridiculous.
He wouldn't let Nola come near him. So she sort of backed her, and I thought, this is what he wants. So I proceed with the interview. I happened to see this interview about 6 or 9 months later, a rerun of the interview on the BBC in London. And, Gareth, I thought, oh, God, no wonder we've got a problem. Not only did he look... he had a florid
sweaty
complexion.
Sweaty and disgusting.
He had a florid complexion. But, this... the world will not tell us what to do. The finger. You
this
can't
grumpy,
see Mrs. Red.
Grumpy,
this grumpy, belligerent old bastard shaking his finger. And I thought, no wonder we've got a major public relations problem here.
But isn't
this
it
is
true?
The Prime Minister of South Africa.
I mean, that must have been... that was, the 60s?
No, that was the early 70s.
Okay, but
it was early 70s.
Then 10 years before, when Nixon had run against Kennedy.
Yes.
And they had televised a live debate.
Yes.
There was a lot of controversy. This is covered in a number of documentaries since then.
Yes.
About how Nixon was sweaty.
Yes.
And he had a five o'clock shadow.
He didn't
look, and then Kennedy was this charming, handsome-looking guy.
Right.
He wore a bit of makeup, so he looked even better.
Which helped him,
right,
obviously.
And all the people loved Kennedy. Mm-hmm. The ones who listened on the radio thought Nixon did better.
Yes.
The ones who watched on TV thought Kennedy did
better.
The
power of the medium. No. But our politicians, not only did they not understand, they didn't have a clue. They did not have a clue. And when I saw this interview that I'd done in the context of BBC television while sitting in London, I thought, oh, God, quite apart from policies and all the rest of it, the image of the Prime Minister of South Africa as he was, it's a disaster, a total public relations disaster.
Now, you were married to, I don't know if you still are, to Dorianne Berry.
I was. We're divorced.
Mm. Okay. Now,
yes.
Dorianne Berry used to be a very famous news person in South Africa.
Yes. Well, she wasn't specifically a news person.
She was a TV presenter.
She was a presenter. Yes, she did. She was.
And how long were you two married for?
Oh, about 20 years. Yeah.
Incredible.
We were divorced in the mid-90s, yeah.
And you must have met some interesting people and done some interesting things.
Oh, yes, we did. Yeah, sure.
Gone to interesting places? I mean, what kind give us some of the gossip. Give us some of the stars here that you must have met.
Oh, Patrick Duffy from he was Bobby in
Dallas.
Yes, in Dallas.
Yeah.
I met JR, who was,
they came here or did you go there?
No, they were here.
They came to South Africa.
All sorts of people came here. I mean, before television, I was presenting a show in Rhodesia, as it was then, called The South African Scene. I was on camera interviewing people that came to South Africa, like Cliff Richard. That's about the biggest one that you will know. Hermanu Gingold and Maurice Chevalier and people like that.
Yeah.
But I would conduct these interviews with people who came to South Africa on film for Rhodesian television, as it was then. So that was my introduction to television sort of in South Africa at any rate, because by then I'd come back from Canada, which is, I suppose, another reason why I got my job, because I was probably the only South African in the country who had actually television experience overseas, apart from the fact that, I was white, which was obviously a requirement. I think they would have preferred me to be a bit older, but I was and still am to a large extent bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
So I ticked all the boxes and got the job at the age of 30 or whatever I was. It was ridiculous.
Did these people who came out here to promote, obviously, the television show and all the rest of
yes,
it,
yes.
did they have an entourage? Did they have to stay in fancy hotels?
No, they didn't.
Because these days when these stars come out here, they require a lot of maintenance.
I was never aware of that sort of thing at all. I mean, they were happy to come to my home in Northcliffe, which is not a hell of a grand place at all. It's an ordinary home. They were happy to come to have dinner with us and by themselves. They didn't have anybody with them.
Really?
Yeah.
Perhaps they just drive there themselves?
No, no, no. They usually came. They usually came with a South African agent that had brought them here.
Okay.
That's usually what happened. They came with their agents, but it wasn't any big deal. These are ordinary people.
You say it's not a big deal, but at that stage and in the world of television, they were the biggest.
Yes,
stars.
They were.
J.R. Ewing was the world's most famous television.
Yes,
man.
He was. But they, I never got the feeling that they thought that they were. You know, major international stars. I mean, I met a lot of famous people.
Yeah.
And I can't think of one that I ever got the impression, or these people really think they're a big deal and, you know, sort of above themselves. I don't know whether things have changed over the last 40-odd years. They probably have. But in those days, look, there probably were in Hollywood and places like that, some, you know, pretty awful people. But I'd never met them.
Were radio people famous too?
Oh, yes, they were.
They were.
They were very. Esme Everard and John Silver, and there are people in your listeners out there who will certainly, they'll know these names. And Eric Egan, my God, as a child, I grew up with Eric Egan. Quarter past seven is his show. And, radio was a very big deal before television. Springbok Radio was a huge, huge, huge deal in this country before television. It's all we had. There was nothing else.
Yeah, there wasn't anything else.
So the radio people were very, very big in this country.
When did you stop working at the SABC?
They retrenched me in 1995. Yeah, I was
1 year after Democracy. So
yes.
Were you there to see any of the transition?
No, not really. But look, it had been on the cards for a long time. Some of us just sort of gave into the subtle pressure to leave. I didn't. Yeah. I thought, you buggers, if you leave, you're going to have to fire me.
Yeah.
And you're going to have legal reason to fire me. So eventually, they retrenched me with a very nice package, which I used to buy property, which was great. But so that's why I stuck it out. I wasn't going to give them the satisfaction of just, you know, resigning. No, that wasn't going to happen. But they had to. There were 200 of us with the wrong color skin that they had to get rid of. So that was it.
It must be an interesting to sort of sit there through that period, because before it had been the other way around.
Yes.
You know, where if you had a black skin, you wouldn't have been allowed in.
Right.
And certainly not in any meaningful job.
Right.
And then suddenly it turs... 180 degrees.
Yes,
you're in the opposite position.
And now the color of your skin is a problem, irrespective of anything else. Your competence has nothing to do with it.
I think these days that the SABC would take whoever the hell they could get. I mean, what do you make of TV these days? I mean, you watch a lot of series. Do you care about television?
No, I don't. You know, I don't care about it. I'm not interested in it, and I'm certainly not interested in the SABC. It's a closed chapter of my life, I hear what everybody hears about what's going on. It's very sad because, you know, in spite of apartheid, the SABC was an internationally respected organization as being a professional broadcaster, quite apart from the government's policy of apartheid.
Didn't you also have a hand in producing that brilliant Bill Farrar's Shaka Zulu?
Yes, I did.
I mean, that was such a great show.
Oh, it was awesome. It was translated into 8 languages around the world.
I loved that show.
It was awesome. Bill was an amazing man to work with. Impossible to work with it. He was great. But I tell you, that cost me emotional blab, many sleepless nights, because Bill was the kind of creative director, to hell with the bloody budget. You know, I want 10,000 Zulus on the hills of Natal. I don't care that it's going to cost whatever it's going to cost.
Wow.
You know, and of course the finance people upstairs who were allocating the money, they're accountants. They don't understand creative temperament. So I was the buffer between Bill, who was absolutely insane in so many respects, but brilliant, and these people who were very concerned about the money that was being spent.
Was it very expensive?
It was. I can't remember the figures because they changed all the time. But I know there were several meetings that I was summoned to upstairs to the 26th floor to explain what the hell is going on with this money that's being poured out. And I put my job on the line in that respect. I mean, I took responsibility for the success of that show. Had it not worked, look, I don't think the SABC would have fired me, but certainly I would have had a lot of explaining to do.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, it was massively successful.
Yes, it was.
It was the first proper television drama that was produced on that level.
And was accepted internationally. I mean, the Americans loved it. And the SABC made a huge amount of money. So I was forgiven. And I let them know it as well because, it made a lot of money. And so I think that was one of the things about my job that I, in retrospect, think is so important because I was a bridge between creative people who are what they are, and people whose job it is to control money. Oh. You know, there's not an easy mix there.
No.
There's not an easy mix.
Do you have any sort of memorabilia that you keep of that time? And any, you mentioned you have one of those little black and white TVs.
Yes,
a portable TV somewhere.
Yes.
I mean, is there any other stuff that you keep that's kind of just to have a chuckle at, makes you feel nostalgic?
Not really. Not in the context of broadcasting. I've got a little ZX81 computer that I bought in 1972, which started a whole new chapter in my life.
Yeah, because you became a programmer.
I became a programmer, and then I wrote books, and one of them is still on Amazon, although I'm sure it's not being sold anymore. I know it's not being sold anymore because it's outdated. And I've lectured at two universities, UJ and Monash. So my life has totally changed, and television really is a closed chapter, which is great. You know, I've moved on.
Yeah, sure. So, have to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I mean, for what it's worth, thanks for all those great shows.
No, it was wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. My friends in Canada, they couldn't believe, because they said, "What the hell are you going back to that country for? You know, you're crazy. You've got a good job here in Toronto. Why?" And the reasons for my coming back were strange, because purely I discovered that I had roots that I never knew I had. Now, this is a very personal thing. A lot of people can leave and go to live in another country, and it's everything's fine. But I've felt within myself that had I stayed in Canada, which I could have done, and by now being a Canadian citizen, obviously, I would have felt like a guest in Canada.
Yeah.
And whereas here, I can say outrageous things, which I've done on 702, and this sort of thing, and I've got very strong feelings about the present government, as I think most of us have. But I in Canada at that time, I would have been a little bit reticent.
Yeah.
Pierre Trudeau was Justin's father.
Right, he was the Prime Minister.
He was the Prime Minister at that time. Although, I mean, they didn't have any controversial issues compared to what we've
Canada
got.
Canada completely uncontroversial. Yeah,
absolutely. So, you know, but
wasn't
even
true,
so.
Wasn't it true that you had people who thought that they'd bought Afrikaans TVs or English TVs? So imagine people go to a shop and they think they've bought the Afrikaans television because they get home and turn it on and there's only Afrikaans program.
Gareth, you know, people find this... They just don't believe it. But it happened that you'd have – well, I mean, the specific thing that happened was this lady wrote to me. We didn't have email, so she wrote to me. She said, "Mr. Nostergrant, you've got to do something about the extent to which the public are being ripped off by one of these chain stores or whatever." Mm. She said, I bought a television set, and I've paid for it, and I saw it in the shop, and that's the one I want, and it was English. This was at lunchtime. And I get it, it's delivered that afternoon, and it's speaking Afrikaans. Now, they've sent me the wrong television set. I don't want an Afrikaans set. I want an English set. Now, you know, how do you explain?
And didn't people also want the clock.
Oh, the color of the clock.
To match their lounge
decor.
Oh, my
God. Yeah, the clock was on the screen for most of the time, and our programming was limited to 2.5 hours. But, this woman, she said, "Look, I've just had my lounge done, and you know, it would be so nice if you could change the color of the clock to match my curtains." You know, Of course you're laughing. I mean, your entire audience is not believing what I'm saying.
But that's what people thought TV was.
This is what...
It's like a painting.
Yes. Well, and something else. A lot of people weren't sure that people like Michael De Morgan, who was a newsreader, that they couldn't actually see people in their living rooms and in their bedrooms watching television. You know, I know it's ridiculous and it's hard to believe. But this is the kind of world in which I lived. And yeah, it was, you know, 40 years later, of course, it's a joke.
Well, listen, thank you for coming to talk to us this morning. I mean, this is just great stuff. And I love to hear these stories because I think a lot of people who watched those shows, it brings back all kinds of memories to them. But it also kind of reminds us of how far we've come in television. And
yes, indeed it does. Certainly it does. Yeah.
Well done on picking the winning shows.
Thank you. It's been good.
Must have been one hell of a trying thing to do some of the time.
You know, people said to me, how did you choose Dallas? And I remember that very well. I saw the first episode, and I just got a gut feeling this is going to work. And there was no evidence because it hadn't yet been on the air in the States. And I just had a feeling this is going to work. And I was right. It's just
you probably set in motion a trend that is still in place in South Africa where soap operas are the single biggest... Yeah. Ratings generator.
Yes, yes.
I think you started that, and perhaps you're single-handedly responsible for the fact that it's still there now.
Not sure I'm proud of that.
Thank you so much, Robin.
Thank you, Gareth.
What a pleasure to meet you. Robin Knox-Grant. All right. Let me help you with those. Ben, just help her with this. Jane is here. Jane is about to go on maternity leave. She's about to have a baby, which we're very excited about. We had something of a stork tea here for her yesterday. Or was it the day before? Day before. Yeah. Are you ready, Jane? Are you ready for another baby?
Yes, I'm ready, by the way.
You sure?
I'm so scared, actually. I don't know that I'm ready or what.
When is the due date? This coming
in 2 weeks.
Yo. So it's just around the corner.
Just around the corner. Anytime the baby can just pop around here, actually.
Well, please don't do that.
Actually, that's the thing that I was expecting to have a baby in this office, by the way.
Maybe not. Not such a good idea.
Why?
Well, because where would you have it? I mean, you know...
In your office, by the way.
In my office.
You would deliver it.
Ben, you are here. Gareth is here.
Yeah, but we don't know how to
so
deliver
you can
a baby.
Experience something
do you
to deliver the
baby. Do you want me to deliver your baby?
I
want everyone to experience something, guys.
Sia, won't you come and deliver Jane's baby? Let's see what he does.
Yeah.
Won't you deliver Jane's baby?
I don't know if I'm qualified. Jane has put me on the list to take her to hospital. And sometimes you actually don't even like volunteer for these things because she just signs you up no matter what.
Well, before you go on your leave, I wanted to talk to you about something because you mentioned to me that you've got a house in Limpopo, right?
Yes.
And that you have a problem there with snakes.
A lot of snakes. A lot. Not one snake. A lot.
Puff adders,
like,
and cobras.
You know, everything.
Scarp stickers.
Have you got big pythons there as well?
You know what? Because, it's, you know, the problem is next to the river.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of water. And other snakes, they stay in the water.
Mm.
Like in the morning when it's hot, they came out of the water and they went to my house, actually.
And do they just come onto the... They actually come into your house?
Yeah.
Onto the floor?
Yeah.
That's us.
Because we stay in the rural area. You know, in the rural area, there's a lot.
What's the place called?
Zanin, Haskoror, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of snake, actually. We live with a snake every day. Because, you know, when we have a lot of trees, the mango, banana, avocados, those things, they're green. Other snakes are green. You see, can't even see that the snake.
Wormslang.
Yes.
Now, what do you do with these things? Because you said to me you don't have a gun and you don't like to.
You can't kill a snake with a gun, guys.
Yes, you can. My father used to shoot snakes.
Oh my God! How?
A snake would come into the kitchen. He'd pull out his revolver and he'd shoot the snake in the head.
No, you know, we. Oh my God.
Back when men were men.
He'd say, bloody snake. He'd pull out his gun and he'd shoot it. What do you do? Do you take a spade? Because we used to do that as well.
Yeah, we used, my mom last week, she called me again. She was at my house. Mm-hmm. She saw a big snake and the snake wanted to attack her because she didn't see the snake. Mm-hmm. She was busy doing the farming because now there's a lot of mealy and everything.
Okay, so you grow mealies.
Yeah.
Cool.
So she was busy taking the mealy out and the snake was like...
Is it one of those that went up?
Yeah.
Like a spitting cobra.
And she said she ran Lentals. And she lie on the floor.
Oh my God, that's not a good plan.
Yeah, and the neighbor came, they say, you know what, this snake, they come here every day because they want to eat the chicken. They eat the chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what is the best way to kill them?
I don't know.
Can't use poison. What was the thing that you said that you were going to try?
Because Lucas suggests the oil thing.
Oil?
Yeah.
Lucas, what kind of oil... What oil do you want to put down in front of the snakes? This is the most crappy idea I've ever heard.
Never heard of.
You want to put down oil, you think it's going to keep a snake away. What, diesel oil? What kind of oil? What sort of engine oil?
Yeah, because my mom suggested the diesel, the smell.
Well, listen to this, one of the inventions by the great Lucas.
Okay.
Yeah, I've discovered that used oil from cars does like chase snakes away.
Really?
The smell.
Maybe because it's poisonous for them.
Yeah.
And the dogs and the cats and every other animal around?
For that, you know.
Collateral damage.
What about rabbits? They would definitely.
Nah. I don't experiment on them.
But now, Jane, if you try the oil and it doesn't work, what's your next course of action?
You know, we live with a snake. Since I was born, I've been living with a snake forever.
Has anyone you know been killed by snakes?
A lot of people.
Really?
A lot. Because this is a big snake. And a lot of people. A lot. And we know if you bite the snake, you have to put something here for the blood not go everywhere to your body. So to avoid everything, so before they take you to the hospital. Because we live with the snake. Because we have like a lot of mangoes, bananas, avocado in the yard.
Yes. You see. But, I would say I'm going to give you a sword. Like a long sword and you can just chop.
What about if it's a big snake?
Chop.
How?
You
stab it.
Yeah, stab it in the head.
You think the snake can just stand there and say, see, I can just stab me?
What does it do?
Snake fight with you. If you know, if the snake, they can see that you're fighting, they fight back.
Jesus.
They fight back.
What's the most scary snake? Is it those fat ones?
No, the most scary snake's the black one, Black Mamba.
Black Mamba,
the one that we had.
Yes. Shit is.
You know, last time, because we use, you know, at the rural area, we use those bathroom, the one that we dig.
Mm.
You know those one?
Yeah.
So last time I was at home, I remember, I went to the bathroom. My neighbor called me, you know what? She was like, please don't use that bathroom. There's a big mamba that into the bathroom. There's a big snake there. So before you go to the bathroom, you have to take a torch and torch inside because the snake like to sit into the
In the toilet?
In the shit.
Yeah.
It sits in the shit?
Yeah.
No.
I'm telling you.
Because it's warm, huh?
Because it's warm. So once you just take everything off and say you sit there, the snake can just bite you.
Maybe you need to have meowsers. I think meowsers can solve this problem.
Yeah, maybe Ben's cat can kill the snake.
Ben's cat. Like, it's
no. No.
Well, Jane, listen, please. You're not going anywhere near the snakes while you're having your baby, right?
Nothing I can do, Gareth. Nothing. Because sometimes we sleep with the snake in the house. Nothing we can do.
Oh, my God. Well, please keep the child safe.
You know, before we used to say, in our culture, they say you can put the cement on the floor. And the snake will never walk around on the floor. But these days they can do that.
They've developed immunity to the concrete floors.
You see, people now, they put in these tiles. Those tiles, you know, the tiles, the expensive tiles. But the snakes still walk on those tiles. So we'll never know.
Please be safe. And we will be thinking about you. We'll miss you while you're away.
Mm-hmm. And we'll miss you the most.
I don't know what we're going to do without you here because these bathrooms,
Oh, my God. Gareth, don't talk about that. I just finished to eat my fresh fruits. What? I don't want to vomit while I'm here. I said, believe Ben.
Is there a substitute, Jane, coming in?
No, we've got someone who's going to come and help out. But Jane will be back, in a couple of months?
Yeah, but, you know.
5 months, Jane? Six.
You know, Ben just wants to get rid of me. I don't know why. What's wrong with you, Ben?
Well, because you like Daniela and you don't like him.
You see, when you see ugliest people in your face every day, you just feel like, I don't want my baby to be like Ben.
Yeah, every day you call me ugly and say horrible things. You actually call me ugly, like I'm the elephant man.
And what
man.
Do you call me?
I say, hi, Jane, how are you today? You look very nice. And what do you say? Shut up, Ben.
When I arrived here this morning, I said, can I say hi, Jane? And you just say, hi, Jane.
I said hi. Like, and then what? You ignore me. And then it's like afterwards, like, hi. I was like, yeah, I've already said hi to you. What do you want?
Ooh.
Oh my God.
Must I say hi 4 times?
Yeah, you must do that.
Well, how about you listen
to hi, Jane. Just say hi, Jane. When
I did. Every time.
Every time.
Every time.
Did you say hi to me today? Gareth is the one who says hi, Jane.
Listen, everybody, we got to get out of here. It's time for... This is what happens,
why
by the way.
Why do you hate me so much?
Shut up, you
why
two.
Why do you hate me
both
so much?
Both of you, shut
oh,
up.
Oh, my
I'm
goodness.
Polite. Right. This is going to carry on all more.
They need a therapy session.
They do. Thank you, you
oh
two.
Oh, my God.
Lovely to see you both. Thank you very much, Jane. All the best with your baby that's coming. Ben, thank you very much. The two of you can go and sort this out in your spare time. Jacob Gedleyihlekazuma continues to come under fire for manipulating the country for his own gains, with many calling him a tactless, evil, unscrupulous man. ANC spokesperson Zizi Kodwa came out in defense of these statements. He said the president cannot be called tactless. He is, after all, going to fire Pravin Gordhan and plunge the country into fresh economic ruin after the Ahmed Kathrada funeral, but not before. A tactless man would do it before. Other news, recently divorced Scarlett Johansson has revealed who she thinks is the sexiest man on earth right now. She says it's Gordon Ramsay, to which the celebrity chef responded, "Why the fuck didn't she fucking say it before I got fucking married and had 8 fucking children?" And finally, Bafana Bafana have extended their record unbeaten streak to 17 matches. Nobody quite knows what to say about this. For years, everyone's become so used to making jokes about the team. The team are riding the wave, though. They're well aware that such a streak will unfortunately attract a painful photo session with Fikile Mbalula at some stage. Even when you lose, you win. And even when you win, you lose. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have a good day. CliffCentral.com